Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm welcome to our warm-up speaker, John.
My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. What do you guys want to hear? My mom, Pat, is the main speaker tonight, and I'm here because she's making me do this. You wanted the truth? No. No, I'm glad to be here. I actually used to live in Tulare back when I was in grade school. One of the 12 different schools that I changed through K through 12. My sobriety date is August 25th, 2015. It's been a little over 7 months, or 19 and a half million seconds. I've constantly have lived a life of trying to fit in. I don't know if it has to do with the moves, because trying to make new friends almost every other year, the easiest way was to be that guy, to be the guy that was willing to do anything for attention, willing to do anything to be a part of the group. And honestly, deep down, it's because I didn't ever really believe somebody was going to like the real me. You know, the real me is boring. Nobody wants to hang out with the real me. And obviously that snowballed into drinking, drugs, anything that could get me out of reality. I'm good at that. I'm good at hiding. I'm good at manipulating. Excellent at lying. And the scary thing is, it has nothing to do with alcohol. That's me. That's my defect. Those are my problems. The benefit of being sober is that now I actually have to deal with it. Now I have to face it. And I can sit here and say that I've tried to quit before. March 2009, I went cold turkey from alcohol and every other, you know, substance I was abusing at the time. And 6 months later, I was admitted to a loony bin and lost custody of my daughter. And I had, at that time, full custody for 7 years. And then having to face people, everybody that knew that John was a full-time dad. And then having to face that music, going back, and I remember going to the grocery store literally right before they're closing, just so I didn't have to see anybody I might know. Hiding. Staying in my house. Embarrassed. Completely pissed off at God. Completely. I thought I was doing the right thing. And then saying it's a chemical imbalance. And then making the choice that, well, if I made it that long with having a chemical imbalance and only got in trouble a few times, you know, why not? And so I made the choice just to stick with it. Why not? And that didn't work out so well. Hit and run and some jail time. So I quit again. And this time I was determined. And because determination is supposed to do everything, right? And about 6 months later, I was drinking again. Actually, the very first night, blacked out and was knocking on somebody's door that I wasn't even supposed to be there. Didn't even know who lived there, but in my mind I thought I was supposed to be there. And the guy that I was staying with told me that if I didn't leave at the moment that I did, I would have gotten shot. That his neighbor had a gun ready to pull the trigger because I was trying to get in through their back door. And that was the first night after 6 months of being sober on my own. And it wasn't until I hit rock bottom again. I really just had to confess to a few people that I was an alcoholic. And come to terms with that. Went to a few meetings, heard other people say it, so it made it easier for me to say it. But until I really was able to go over and get through that first step, really believing it, that's when it really started to work. I'm thankful, and it's nobody could do this, not even me, no doctors, not anybody. But to have the obsession removed is the biggest gift that God has given me yet. Not that I don't think about it every once in a while, but I don't think about drinking. When I think about it, I think about all the havoc and the problems associated to it and what I've done to other people, the hurt that I've caused, the hiding, the not being me. That's what I can associate with now. And with those 19,500,000 seconds, every second, right now, every second is a new record for me. It's a new record for sobriety. And I couldn't have done it without these rooms. I couldn't do it if you guys weren't honest. I wouldn't be honest. We'd just be a bunch of lying people getting together, lying about how great life is. But I think that's it. Any questions? Thank you.
Let's give a warm welcome to our featured speaker, Pat.
Look at Pat, everybody. I got my tissue.
Hi, my name's Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Rick for asking me to speak tonight, and I want to thank you and Lon for the wonderful hospitality and dinner that we had tonight for my son and I. And a lot of you have heard my story before, and I'll just start off with that. I'm half Native American. I had my mom had left when I was 5. She had 2 children, me and my younger brother. He's a year and 9 days younger than me. And when she turned 21, she left. And so my dad raised me, and a couple years later, he got remarried. And so I had a stepmom. So from this point on, I'd be calling them my parents because I didn't see her again until I was 30, and that was because I went and looked for her. So growing up, I felt I was very shy. Did what I was told, kind of didn't feel like part of the family. They continued to have more children, which, you know, I was now the oldest, and by the time I was a sophomore in high school, they had 5 more children. And I thought, I'm never having kids, because I was tired of babysitting, I was tired of doing house chores, I was just like, I was the second mom to these kids. And I couldn't wait to move out. there was a period of time during my junior high years that I used to go to the library. I'd walk to the library for peace and quiet. And I would go to the library to look at, there's these books, in fact, I found them on Amazon, and I have a few of them at home now. It's the best cartoons of the year, 1968 or 69. I would sit in the library, it was nice and quiet, you know, just no screaming kids. And I would just read these things and just laugh. You know, it was self, as a child, like I was really self-helping myself. Like I just needed something to bring some laughter to my life. But I wasn't thinking that, like, I need to go get laughter in my life. I just kind of naturally went and did that. There was another time I guess it's that 13, 14-year-old where you really need your mom. You know, and I didn't have that mom-daughter relationship with my stepmom. And I actually went to the police department in our little town of Manteca, where Sherry. And I just walked in there. I didn't know what to do. And I said, how do you find a missing person? And I don't remember the answer, but I knew whatever was required that I wasn't going to be able to follow through with that, you know. So, but I had some really good school friends. I've had them since the sixth grade. They're still my friends today. And I really clung on to them for just friends. God gave me good friends. As soon as high school was over, graduated, I was out of there. Me and girlfriend of mine rented a small little apartment in Stockton above an aquarium. It was $150 a month, and we had little cheap minimum wage jobs, but we could afford that. And we did that for a while until we found out that our other friends were renting a house in Manteca that five of us could live in there. So we had five, you know, 20-year-olds, 21, 22-year-olds living in this house, and it was like party city, you know. My first taste of alcohol was at my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, and I had a sip of champagne, and it was like, oh, this is so good. You know, for your first drink of alcohol, and it's champagne, and I just loved it. But I didn't go on to drinking until high school, and that's when I, you know, tried it a little bit more. And then in my yearbook, everybody said, you're shy until you've had a few. You know, that's how it was. It was true. You know, you're really a lot of fun when you've had a few beers, and it's kind of like that positive reinforcement. But I really, you know, anyways, after high school, moving out and being with my friends, my drinking was hard alcohol. I like to get a small pint of whatever, and that was what I would drink and chase it with something I like root beer. That was like my drink, was a little small bottle of some Canadian Mist. That was usually what I would take, and then just drink the root beer because I like the root beer, and I wanted to be a part of, so I had to get some courage up. But I remember going to a party and just stumbled into the entryway. I mean, hadn't even started, and I broke a vase, and, you know, walked in. I'm thinking, who puts vases in the entryway? And I remember just going sitting in the living room, and everybody else partied, and I just sat there. You know, I was fine drunk. I was just fine. I was comfortable. That was, you know, the comfortable thing to do. Terrible stuff happened, you know. I mean, and I don't say it a whole lot, but for this purpose, by the time I was 19, I had had two abortions. You know, for some reason, I didn't know how to say no, and I didn't want anybody to know, and I didn't tell anybody. Maybe one person. I mean, I took myself to go do it. The second time was like, you know, one time bad, two times, that's pretty bad, you know, to go do this again, and I felt horrible, you know. But then again, you know, the behavior that comes with alcohol and the things that I would do, now I'm learning how to forget it. how do I just move on with my life and put this stuff away and not think about it again? And I got to be really good at it because it really bothered me for a long time, and I knew that time would help me forget. So I tried a lot of other issue type, you know, drugs, whatever. There's a few things I wouldn't touch because I didn't like needles. And I'm lucky I lived through them. You know, I would do them with my friends and wonder if I was ever going to come down off of them. But alcohol was like, just, that's all I wanted. Just give me that. I could handle drinking. And so then it didn't take long before I thought, this, it kind of got old now. You know, my friends were kind of going the way. I didn't want to go that direction. They were hanging really with the hard biker group that, even though I tried to fit in, I didn't feel fit in, and so wasn't partying with them as much. And then, you know, I got this job, and it was in Stockton, and then I met this guy, and I asked him if he was married, and he said no, and we saw each other for about 3 months, and the women at work were saying, you know, he's married. You know, he's married. And I'm thinking, no. I'm thinking, no, he said he wasn't married. And then I found out he was married. But it was kind of like, you know, the same thing where I couldn't really, you know, my morals and my making decisions and sticking up for myself, I just didn't. And, you know, more things to add to my disgust about myself and still trying to, let's move forward and, you know, I'll get through this. And, you know, I started this thing, I'm going to follow it through. And he left his wife and we got married. And, you know, I had that attitude, you know, I kind of like, I made my bed, I'm going to sleep in it kind of attitude. And, you know, and I really tried, you know, with all my best intentions that I was going to be married and it was going to be forever. And we got married. We went to Tahoe. We lived at Stockton at the time. And we got married at 3 o'clock in the morning because we won some money. You know, we just went down to wherever. And it was like, that's fine. You know, it was like I was just whatever. It was, but really, it would have been like, you know, could I ever do it the right way? You know, but it wasn't. I'm going to say it was less than a month. You know, we're sitting in his truck driving along, and I am still not. I'm shy. I'm quiet. Put something in me, and I'm not so shy and quiet. But right now, I'm, like, really not doing anything, drinking or anything. But I'm looking out the window. We're driving down the road, and I'm just quiet. I'm kind of, like, just enjoying the scenery. I don't have to be chatting the whole time. And this is what you get for not getting to know someone before you hook up with them, you know. And but that's how, I think that's how I just did it, you know. Have sex, get married, and then find out who they are. I'm looking out the window, and then I hear, who are you looking at? I mean, and not in a nice tone of voice. And I'm telling you what, from that point on, I lived with a lump in my chest. And I walked on eggshells for the next 10 years. And I bet I was the best mom I could. I had Jonathan, and a couple years later, we had my younger son, Stephen. And it was like, those were my lifesavers. You know, those were my, you know, I did everything to be the best mom I could. And I didn't do a perfect job, you know. But I stuck it out until, you know, I couldn't do it anymore. And we moved to Tulare in 88. And it was a multiple things that happened, and one of them was that, I'll say this, I believe he was seeing someone, but then I was also seeing someone too, and it kind of all came to a head, and we ended up getting divorced. I moved out of the house. I got kicked out, you know, because there was a time when I thought, I don't even know who I am. You know, I knew I couldn't stay in this relationship, but I didn't know how to get out. I was afraid. And, but I did, and same thing is not getting to know the person who I'm with before I hook up with them, because this guy was married too, but I knew that. But, you know, when someone talks me into the work, this is going to work out, you know, and, you know, he's going to take care of it all, and I'm same thing. I can't make a decision or say no or have some boundaries, and I go along with it, and I'm okay with that because I really like this guy. He's a nice guy. Everybody likes him. And, of course, long story short, that doesn't work out. We're together 6 years, and I actually catch him with somebody else multiple times. He moves out multiple times. And I know Jonathan remembers. I remember him and Steven, sitting. The guy would come after moving out and try to come home, move out, come home. This was a roller coaster from, and that's when I started drinking. I wasn't drinking during this other marriage, but I started drinking in this one. And I would go, because he would move out. And when he would come home to try to move back home, he'd be at the door crying. And I would, like, feel bad, and I'd let him back in again. And they're on the other side going, no, you know, but I'm like, I can't, guy's crying at the door, you know. But it would happen more than once. And those are things that, you know, later on I'd be like, you know, what kind of person was I? Hated me long before this happened, you know. And I was just like, how am I going to do this right? What can I do this right? Maybe, you know, if I give him a chance, maybe it's going to work out. Maybe he's going to tell me the truth. Maybe he's going to stay. And he didn't stay. And it just came to the point that one day I made the decision. I says, you're out. And when I did, I just felt such a huge relief that I finally made a decision for myself that was a good decision. It was a very good decision. And I kind of moped around the house for a while, but I had booze. You know, I was buying booze, hid it in the top counter above the fridge. I thought. But I would drink when I got home from work. I wouldn't drink at work, but I'd come home, drink over-the-counter sleeping pills so I could get to sleep at night. And there was a period of a year that I would tell my friends that knew me at the time, I guarantee you I cried a bucket of tears. So it was a woe is me my whole life, but this was the worst part of it. You know, it was like, here I was by myself. Now I get to do this by myself, you know, make some decisions, make some good decisions about myself. And then, of course, the kids tell me, hey, our friends' moms are single and they're going to go out. So I started going out with them and partying. And I was like, ooh, that sounds good. And so I take a drink before I would go, and they would drive, and we'd go to Visalia, and I lived in Lemoore, and started that little back and forth on the weekends. Pretty soon I'm doing it by myself, because they've got boyfriends now, but I'm still going out, and I'm drinking and driving now. It was just a matter of time, like it says, that the woman alcoholic goes down pretty fast, and that's what happened to me. You know, I can't handle alcohol. I knew that back in 1987. I met my mom. I was 30 years old. It had been 25 years since I seen her, and she was in a park in Nevada near where our reservation was with a big bottle of booze in front of her. And it really broke my heart that what I had heard was that there was a drinking problem in this family, and that yet to see it was very sad. And we didn't really have a good, we just now just wrote letters here and there. And then in 1996, I got a letter 2 weeks after she died from her son, from her second marriage, who I get to have a relationship with him now. He lives in North Carolina. And he got to tell me about that lifestyle. He grew up with that alcoholic family. You know, our mom was an alcoholic. Her husband was an alcoholic. And then my brother ended up going to Alcoholics for the AC, Adult Children of Alcoholics. And he just said he felt like he was the adult and they were the children. You know, and I didn't really understand really about alcoholism then. That was, so that kind of went backwards on that because that was 96. When I kicked second husband out, it was 2000. And so I'm drinking and driving and partying as much as I can. Started on Saturday, then it went to Friday, Saturday, and then it went to Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then, you know, there's always something going on when you're looking. Like, there's country western dance starts at this time, at this place, and, you know, and I'm starting this routine of that I need to go have booze, and it's the only way I think I know how I'm going to meet people. Like, oh, I just, the next thing is finding him again. And kind of, but kind of not, it's like, I get my pick now, you know. And 2003, and this is a routine. I'd leave work. I worked in Wrigley, and I would couldn't wait for happy hour, and I'm watching the clock, and I'd stop at Riverland, go down 99, and go home, and Visalia, because that's where I live now at this time. And then it was April of 2003, and I got my first DUI at 1 in the morning. It was a Friday night, so not Saturday morning because it was after work on Friday, but complete blackout, different change of clothes, parked on the side of the road, somewhere between here and Riverland, out in the country, parked neatly off the side in the dirt. I don't remember anything. And I don't even remember having more than one beer when I was there. But for some reason, I got home, out, back again. It kind of was, that was like a routine of mine, was drink, go home, change my clothes, go back out. So whatever my brain was telling me, that's what it was doing. I never, my youngest son was living with me at the time, and we were talking about it, and he goes, I can tell when you're in a blackout. He goes, because you'd look right through me. You know, I'd come home, and he worried a lot about when I was going to come home, or, you know, and I'm just bad mom. I let him drink at home. Jonathan was in Bakersfield. He had just had his, he had a daughter that was just born, and I'd be late visiting them on a Saturday. Instead of being there at 10 in the morning, I'd get there at 2, and I'd feel miserable, and it was just, that's just how it was. I got sick a lot. I couldn't handle my alcohol, but I'd want to do it all over again because I'd want to figure out what was the right combination. Was it the wine? Was it mixing it? You know, don't eat food, eat food. You know, I did all that. So 2003, I get my first DUI. I'm devastated. I can't even talk. Can't even tell them where I work or what I do. I can think it in my head, but it won't come out of my mouth. I'm embarrassed. I threw up all over the sheriff's shoes. They put on the paper that I had something green. They like put something on there that I ate that was green. It was like, I don't remember eating anything green. So I get booked. Got to go to court. You know, I just pleaded no contest. I was just, I don't know what to do. I didn't get an attorney. I just thought, you know, I'm just going to do whatever I got to do to get this behind me, pay my fines, whatever. Just tell me what to do. So I do that alternative services for 6 months. I had to do 12 AA meetings. And I came and I sat in the back and I did different meetings and I didn't want to be here. I just thought, I just got in trouble by chance, and paid all my fines, and same thing, like everything else, up, out of, outside, out of mind, done, move on. And that next year, I went to some outside counseling for some other things, and then I went to a hypnotist. Because I really just didn't want to drink that much. Still, the drinking bothered me, and I thought, I told her my whole story. I was kind of pretty honest with her about my drinking, and I got in trouble, and I don't want to drink like that anymore. I figured, she's not going to tell anybody. She doesn't care. But I really wanted her to help me to just have two drinks. So she made this little cassette for me, and she talked through it. She said, listen to this before you go out. But the thing that was so funny was the part where it got to, I just want to be a two-drink lady. And I thought, oh, my God, I couldn't get into it because I thought, lady? I just want to hear something like, just have two drinks. Like, you know how you think hypnotism is. Just have two drinks. But you go in there, two drinks goes fast. I don't care what you're drinking. It's like, don't even go out if you're just going to have two. So, you know, it was this that same thing. It's like just kind of, I wanted more willpower. Like, you know, I got to take more control and drink at different places. So I did. And I thought I'm going to, because before I would drink at the Pump House and the Green Olive and Circe's and all these really fancy places. Well, this time I really thought I'm going to go to Applebee's and Amigos and Red Robin. You know, that was a bump up. And no, and I changed too. It's like, if it was a beer, it was make sure it had, I'd never left, finish your drink before you leave the bar, because I thought someone put something in my drink that last time, you know. Or drink a little while here, drive to this one, drink a little while here, drive to that one, drink a little while here, you know. And then my body tells me to go home when it's time to go home, and I'm lucky I get home every time. And this happens more, it's happening more during the week than not. And I lived close to Goshen and Acres at the time, and I would just come home from Reedley to Goshen, I'd turn on Acres and go to Applebee's. My body just goes that way every day. Just take a drink. And then sometimes after this DUI, I'm like, go home. Just go home. This one day I decide, well, before that, let's get back it up. After the hypnotist thing, and it didn't work. I just put the tape. I still have the tape. I need to pull that one. It's somewhere. And then when I throw that stuff away, it's really important. In fact, I did save all that stuff. I even saved the big book they gave me when I came to do these 12 meetings. But I read it, and I looked at it and tried to read the pages, and it just didn't make sense to me. And then in October of 04, I go to an end-of-the-year meeting at work, and I'm on probation now for driving, you know, drinking and driving. But I'm driving anyway. You know, I'm driving and I'm drinking. The meeting's up at Tenaya Lodge. I have an ice chest full of beer in the trunk. October, Halloween weekend, 2004, freak snowstorm. We have to wait, so we're waiting in Oakhurst for the snow to get the roads to get cleared, and me and my friends are drinking beer. So finally they let us through, and we get in our cars and we go. I get out of my car because I have to put chains on. Well, I know how to put chains on my car because I've done it before. So I get out and I'm putting chains on my car, but I don't do a good job. And I think, oh, it's fine. You know, it'll get me to Tenaya. Well, I didn't get very far, and the chain got caught in the axle, and my car braked, like, on its own, and my car started to slide this way, sideways, almost like towards the cliff. Well, the higher patrolman came, and I was more concerned about not going off the cliff than had been drinking and being on probation. I just kind of, like, didn't really think about it, and since it seemed like an emergency situation, he helped me get the chain off, and then he let me follow him all the way, or no, he followed me all the way to Tenaya Lodge. Got me to Tenaya Lodge safely. I was wet and dirty from trying to put those chains on, and so I get out, and I got my ice chest behind me. This is a nice lodge. And I'm wet, and I'm dragging this thing in behind me. And I really don't care, but I just want to get my room, so I get in my room, and I drink, and that night was like, I just wanted to drink and party and have fun. This was the end of the year meeting, and these people were boring. But I had a few friends that were drinking with me, so, you know, we'd go to this dinner thing, and I was bringing beers from upstairs down to, and you're not supposed to do that when you're in a hotel, apparently. But long story short, lose my keys in the snow, we had to have my car towed the next day. Then next week after that, I get a letter from work saying my behavior was unacceptable at this year-end party. And so I called my friends I was partying with. I go, did you guys get a letter? And they go, yeah. And I go, well, mine shredded, because I shredded it before I finished reading it. I said, send me a copy because I really want to read it. I was so mad because it wasn't that bad. It was a boring party. They just... Anyway, it's really how I felt. It was like, this is dumb. And that was October. Before Christmas, after Christmas and before New Year's, I go out Tuesday night, you know, drinking night, like I normally do, except this time I had gone to the store and I thought, I need to just go home. I was really kind of, this drinking, it was getting out of hand. And I was always thinking about just stay home, just stay home, just stay home. Don't go out tonight, especially Tuesday, really. And I talked myself into going out. And in fact, I was going out to the parking lot. I was going, should I go home? Should I just go that way or that way? And I was like, you know, it was always go to where the drinking is. You know, and I think I'm just going to go have one, and I don't just have one. I go in, and I want the tall one. You know how you can get the tall glass? I had like two or three of those, and then they gave me a shot of something that tasted like peanut butter jelly sandwich. And then I had a short one, and I'm thinking, okay, it's time to go home. And then I go home, but I get dressed to go back out. Because now it's like, I'm ready to go now. You know, it's got that rev going. I'm going to go out because I might miss something out there, and I can go drink with the people that I know. And as soon as I walk in the bar, and I don't go to Applebee's now, I go back to my roots. That was the bliss, I think it was. So I walk in, and immediately somebody's buying me a beer, you know, and I drink a beer, and I'm out till 12:30 or 1, and I'm thinking it's time to go home. And my same thing, I have this clock, internal clock, that just gets up and goes. I go home. If I'm with friends, they next day they're always telling me, where'd you go? You got a house when you're leaving. And but I go down, I parked on Main Street because I didn't want to park by the bar. So I walk down the corner and I see my car. It's the only one on the street. I get in my car and I don't remember anything after that. Apparently I went through McDonald's. I don't know. Maybe they called me in or whatever. I go through McDonald's and I come to on Demery with a hamburger in one hand, soda down here, and I'm eating and driving. And I come to because the lights come on behind me. And it's really a wake-a-rupper. And I'm sick to my stomach. You know, immediately for that moment, I'm thinking, here I am again. And I'm really wondering where this food came from. So I pull over, you know, immediately, and I sit there, and then he comes, gets my license, and then he makes me get out, and I did some tests, and I'm sure I didn't do a good job, but he comes over, and this is the first time anybody's challenged me on my drinking, and he says, do you have a drinking problem? You know, and that, I didn't say anything. I'm back to child now. Quiet, shy, not saying nothing, feeling pretty horrible. And he goes, I'm the one who arrested you the first time. Put the cuffs on me, put me in the back seat, and then I blacked out again. And, oh, before he gave me the breathalyzer, I said, no, I want to take blood. Because I had planned that the last time, that I wasn't going to do the breathalyzer if I ever got caught again, even though I said I'd never do that again. You know, I was making all these plans, or take a different route home every time. You know, I had an alternate plan. That plan was out the door, and I said, no, I'm just, you know, I'm going to take blood. I don't want to do the breathalyzer. So they took me to, I'm on Demery, you know, Mill Creek Drive, and the jail's like one little loopy drive down to the jail, and I don't remember any of that. They took blood. The reason why they know they took blood was because a day or two later, my arm was full of bruises from where they tried to find a vein, I'm sure. But I came to when I got out to Bob Wiley, and they booked me, and I really tried to straighten up and look good for the picture. And then the next day, my youngest son, who was living with me, came and picked me up. And we went to go see if my car was there, because the last time they had towed it. And so we went by to go see if it was still parked there, and it was. It was still parked there. My purse was in the back seat. The food was still in the car. The right rear tire was on the curb, and the rest of the car was on the street. How I parked. And it was pretty embarrassing when I had my youngest son with me, and we looked at it, and I thought, oh, thank God my car's here. So the keys were in my purse, took my car home. It's Wednesday. I go home, clean up, and I go to work. And I don't feel good. I'm still hungover, but I go to work because that's what I do. I'm not a high-functioning alcoholic. I'm a functioning alcoholic. You know, I'll do whatever. Now, I could get sick in my bathroom. I had an office that had it inside my own bathroom. So I could stay in there all day, tell whatever, whoever, just don't bother me today. But I wasn't going to not go to work. And that was the beginning of, what am I going to do now? Well, New Year's is coming up, because this is like December 28th. And I go rent at least 4 DVDs. And I know Jonathan were talking on the phone with Stephen. And Stephen was living with me, and they says, Mom, they felt sorry for me to stay home on New Year's Eve with four DVDs, all sad. And they said, just don't drink and drive. You know, take a taxi. And I thought, you know, they talked me into going out. It's their fault. So, anyways, I did want to go out. I wanted to drink away those problems. I wanted to just drown my sorrows. And I wanted to go have fun. So, like, any normal person wouldn't do that. You know, that's just insanity. And I go out and I drink a lot, and I can't get drunk. And I drive home, and thank God I didn't get pulled over. The next day I drank some more on the 1st, and that, you know, January 2nd, 2005 became my sobriety date. I was done, but now I'm sad. I've got this sad, I can't do anything about this crying. I don't want to drink it away. And I did go to the doctor and get something for the anxiety because I was just a mess. And I'm not a pill taker, so I just used it for a little while. I didn't even finish it just to get past that week. And I had called EAP, and they says, go to 90 meetings, 90 days. And the guy on the phone says, I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know what the chances are of somebody being an alcoholic when they answer those phones for employee assistance programs. But this guy was one. He says, and don't get off the phone. He goes, I'll get you some outside help. So I did. I went to a meeting that next Sunday because I knew there was one at the Blue Room. And I went in there, and I sat by the door in the corner, and I was early and not late, like I thought I was late, and I got there 50 minutes early, and Tina was at the table with her little son, Tristan, and I didn't know her at the time, and I knew, she looked at me, and she just waved me, like this, like, come sit by me, and I thought, I knew if I didn't get up and go sit by her, I might not do it again. So I got up, and I went and I sat by her, as hard as that was. And she gave me a meeting list, and she was just the nicest person ever. And she was at the next meeting that I went to, you know, and as I met one, I met two, and I met three, and I met four, and then before you know it, I met grass. Which was fine. I went to outside counseling, and I told her my story, like, as much as I could in the time I had. And she goes, you don't have to drink every day to be an alcoholic. And I wasn't even telling her I was an alcoholic. I was just telling her my story. And so we did our sessions, but I was doing AA now, and I was really wanting to pay attention. And she gave me the meeting list, and I was going to meetings, I was going to the Alana Club every morning because it was pretty close to my line of travel to get to Reedley, stop there, stay there as long as I could, go to work. I was doing a meeting or sometimes two a day. And if I missed one, I'd go to three. I think Saturday you could hit three. And just listening to everyone, and just the fact that I wasn't drinking or that I didn't have to drink anymore, and I could do this one day at a time, I started to feel better. You know, and I had some, there was hope. That, in fact, it was like, this has to work. You know, they told me to start reading the big book. And when I started reading the big book, what I read was, the thing that caught my eye the most, that I said it so much in the beginning, you'd think I wrote it, and that is, it's a design for living that works. And I thought, that's what I need. I needed this. I needed somebody to tell me what to do. I cannot make a decision. And every decision I ever made was horrible. And I'm beating myself up, and I'm crying at every meeting. You know, they were starting to put my name on the tissue box. And it could have been that I was mourning alcohol, but all the stuff started, when I heard the steps and I'd read the promises on the wall, and I thought, that's all I want. I want those promises. I want peace and serenity. I want to feel okay. I want to make a decision for myself and it be okay. But I also knew it was going to take some time. It was going to take some work. And in a few months after being here, I got a sponsor. And we started working the steps and going through the book together. We would read it together, and she was so nurturing. And it was amazing. You know, it was like, this is, I love it. And it was important, you know, and everything. The way it just all laid out was like it just happened like it was supposed to. You know, but now I got to go to court. I get an attorney. I pay as much money as I can. I think the more money I pay for this retainer, the better attorney I'm going to get. And maybe it helped, maybe it didn't. But I got 30 days, and they let me do community service. So I didn't have to go into jail because I had to go into jail last time for 48 hours, and that was like, I don't belong there. Yet they told me, yes, you do. You're just like them. And I get that today. You know, I'm an alcoholic. The pain and the suffering of an alcoholic, I understand what that's like. And it's different for some people, the pain maybe, but being enslaved to that alcohol and thinking, you know, it's going to be different this time, that's the only way, you know, to get by in life, it's not true. You know, for me, I just became really grateful. You know, those tears of being sad and woe is me turned into tears of gratefulness. I couldn't read those 3 and 5 without relating to it, you know, 100%. You know, and what I heard was to be rigorously honest, you know, or if you didn't have the capacity to be honest, you might not get this. That scared me because I didn't know how to be honest. Everything was a lie, you know, and hiding. Maybe it's hereditary. You know, I didn't want anybody to know anything about me. You know, I lived up here. My family didn't know anything about me. They lived in Stockton. And, you know, my dad, I told my dad about 4 years ago, I think it was, you know, what I had gone through. I never wanted to worry him, you know. And he was okay. He just went, oh, yeah, you know, because my brother died in 2003 right after I got my first DUI. He just got out of DVI. He was the kind that went to jail for a booze and jail, out of jail, in jail, out of jail, rehab, jail, like a, you know, group homes and whatever the judge could give him. He was just that annoying alcoholic. And he ended up doing DVI. He was at DVI at this time. He got out and so deep, you know, and the sad thing was that, you know, I wasn't stopping drinking. I stopped drinking for a couple of weeks after he died because I was so angry at alcohol, at what it did to him. They found him face down in the gravel near some railroad tracks under a bridge in Stockton, and I guarantee you it was in the ghetto because that's where he lived. You know, he was gone for 5 years one time, hopped the train, and we don't even know where he went. It's a family disease. It's not a family disease. I've heard, you know, all the stories. So getting through the steps, you know, I would come to these meetings and the things that scared me the most was service and God. You know, I didn't want to stop drinking and I want a better life, but I don't want to do anything. I mean, I don't want to give back. I don't want to, whatever they were talking about, you know, they talk about service and God, and that was the two things that scared me. But I kind of just put it aside because then I would hear people tell me things like, you know, how they found their God, like different ideas, and, you know, was open for ideas. And it was like someone said in a meeting, just make a list of what you want in your God, you know. And what did I want? I didn't want a damning God or one that's going to send me to hell because I made a mistake, because that's how I felt like all my life. You know, might as well go out, you know, on a good note. And so I wrote down loving and understanding and forgiving and, you know, all the good stuff. And he said, well, that's your God. That's God. And it was like, that was so much easier. It was kind of like simple. You know, I realized how simple the program is. The hard part is some of the work. After getting 1, 2, and 3 were pretty easy for me, but really was looking forward to getting through 4. I had so much stuff I needed to tell somebody. Because to me it was horrible. And they say, you don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And none of that stuff I regret. And there's only one regret. We always have that one regret, you know. Don't have any regrets, but I do have a regret. There was one time I asked Jonathan, he's here now, he didn't know this, I asked him to go live with his dad because my second marriage was failing and I thought maybe if I didn't have any kids around, it might work. And I never got him back in my house. He just moved on from there. And that was really hard for me, because I look back on it, so I can't have that time back. You know, and that's, you know, just the way it happens. So I got through four, was looking forward to it, you know, got five done. It, apparently, according to my sponsor at the time, it was the longest fifth step ever. Ever in the history of AA, no. But I was worried about not being thorough, and I wanted it to be, you know, as honest as I could. And but I'm telling you what, it was just like, I'm so glad I got it done, and I got to get that out of me. And it did bring some relief, and I knew now, you know, I wanted her to know everything about me, because I wanted her to call me out on whatever, you know, because I didn't even know if I was acting away or had a confusion about something or was whatever, that she might be able to give me some insight knowing my story. And so that just kind of helped me get through being thoroughly honest and learned about my character defects, which are feel sorry for myself, not feeling good enough. You know, and I know today when that pops up, it can come and go because I don't waddle in it very long. 6 months, I get into service, and I didn't raise my hand. They just said, you're the new secretary. And that was fine. I was willing. I was willing to do whatever, and I had a lot of support, and I had a group of friends that have been there with me through the beginning. I did a lot of meetings in Tulare, and they're my friends today, and two of them are here tonight. And you just never know what you're going to get when you get here, because one of the things I asked for when I was less than 30 days sober, what do newcomers say when they don't know what to say? But I got up and said, I'm an alcoholic. I don't have any sober friends. That was my only sentence. You know, and God blessed me with all of you, you know. I learned to not beat myself up. You know, they said just Rule 62. I had to go figure that one out, too. The grass was very instrumental in getting me to go to a convention within 30 days. And after talking to me for an hour and a half. All that to go to... No. I had so much fun. I really had a lot of fun. That is my home group convention now, the one I go to down in Woodland Hills at the end of January. If anybody ever wants to go, you got to hit me up in October when I start filling out this. It is so much fun, and I look forward to it. Whether I think I might not go or not, I'm going. I'm going to go, and if I go by myself, then I go by myself. But usually I can talk them people into going with me. The scariest time in my life, you know, I've been here a while, a few years now. Well, like they tell you, in your first year, don't get in a relationship. You know, don't make any major decisions. Newcomers still have old behaviors. You know, I'm still looking at the door waiting for the cute guy to walk in, you know. Just like I did at the bars, you know, but I'm sober now. And I did meet someone, and we did have a short relationship, and I had to break it off because I was going through my steps and I realized this was not the right thing to do. This, you know, and I felt really horrible, but it worked out. I mean, nobody drank over it, and, you know, it was just, I realized what they meant by that was it's not good. And got through that, and then the rest of the year. So then on second year, it was like, I don't want to be in a relationship. I was actually really, I got through my steps, really feeling good about myself, and it's like, wow, I wasn't asking my sponsor every single time I was making a decision anymore. I was getting able making decisions on my own, and I would tell her, but it was like, now I was feeling like I'm really participating in my own life, and then year after year two, then I got on Match.com, and I lied about how old I was, and old behavior, and I did some dating outside the rooms, and that was, you know, it happened that way for a reason. I'm glad, because they never worked out. I picked drunks, and God is my witness, fall down drunks. You know, it was like, how do I pick them? They can't even pick them sober, you know. And but you know, that was a learning lesson, you know. And the thing was, one of them didn't want to see me anymore, but he tells me over the phone, I'm telling you what, it broke my heart. The lesson, I started writing. My sponsor had me write, and I was writing every day. I was angry, upset, I was hurt. The day he called, I was in pain. It was heartbroken. It was like kind of ego heartbroken type of thing. And I called my friends because that's the only time I really wanted to drink. And I realized for me today that that kind of pain is the, that's probably not so much today if that happened, but I knew I was not ready. I knew I had a lot of work to do on myself. You know, I didn't like myself. I was not near ready. And so there was just more work to be done. And once I learned to like myself, and, you know, it just was a process. And, you know, I learned how to stay present. You know, I was reading, you know, books, outside books will be helpful. And someone in the meeting mentioned The Power of Now. I gravitated toward that book. That was my, to understand spirituality and to have some peace in my life and really stay present, you know, to be. And I started learning how to do prayer and meditation, went to some 12-step, went to a retreat, went to a couple of them actually over the years. And I always get something out of that that's going to be helpful to me. My scariest time where I was going to go to, because this was like 3 or 4 years sober, when Jonathan, what he mentioned about going into the mental hospital, it was devastating. I was afraid because it wasn't him. And I really didn't know what was going on in his life. But I was really, really afraid. And it was one night I was in my room and I was so afraid that I felt fear. It was tangible. And some people might relate to that. But I'm telling you what, I felt like it was coming at me, like heavy. And all I did was just, I started thanking God for the outcome. I said, thank you, God, for whatever you have in store. Thank you for the outcome of this situation. I knew I couldn't change it, and I knew I couldn't cry it away, and I didn't want to be afraid. And until I stopped, until that fear left, and it was just a matter of, I don't even know, less than 5 minutes of me crying to God and asking to just, or not even asking, thanking Him. I stopped asking and thanking Him for whatever He had in store. And it went away, and after that I knew that everything was going to be okay. That was just kind of like the thing I learned now, that just to thank Him and everything. You know, people, places, things, whatever happens. I've got the sponsor, my first sponsor. I had to get a new sponsor. I went probably too long with that one. And of course, you all know she just moved. And that was hard. But I could still talk to her on the phone. And if we need to FaceTime or Skype, then that's there too. But I don't like to do FaceTime or Skype. So I get to talk to her. And she said she'll be here with me in spirit. And, you know, it's the process is just an amazing. The 12 steps, the traditions, the principles. You know, I get to incorporate all that in my life. I'm interested in all of it, you know, to stay in service. I got to retire last year. I did my time. And I said, I'm out of here. Because, you know what, it provides me enough. You know, I have everything I need. I have more than I need. I don't have everything I want. I have just what I have what I need. And I'm still able to, you know, still be able to help, you know, where needed. In closing, what's really been in my heart is that it's the St. Francis prayer. And the part of the prayer is that I'm happier loving other people than to be loved. You know, that's part of that prayer is to, you know, I love the whole prayer, but that is probably the biggest thing right now is that service work. Oh, there was a thing I was going to write that I heard on the speaker tape that Mother Teresa said, and then I forgot to bring my little cheat sheet. But it was about love and service. And all tied in with, had tied in with love, you know, love and it's not to be loved. Love is more important than, loving you is more important than you loving me. I don't require that anymore like I used to, even though I know that's out there, but if I can love you and do a better job of it, then my life is at peace. You know, so that's what is peace, faith, and love. It all turns into, part of that service is service work too, is giving of yourself. So, it is a design for living that works. If you're new here, there isn't a single person here that wouldn't help you get a phone number. We know what it's like to be new. We know what it's like to not be so new and be in pain. And one little quote that I can remember, because I didn't bring my note, just help me out. Because it was so important for me to find a God of my understanding. And that was that religion is for people that don't want to go to hell, and spirituality is for those who have been there. Thank you for listening.